Last time we were talking about embryonic development, then we got into tadpole development, talked about some of the factors that influenced embryonic development here, hatchling development, blah, blah, blah. Okay, come on. Larval development, larval growth. And then we started talking about tadpole feeding ecology and thoughts about whether or not they're microphagous or macrophagous, and then talked about two different types of morphs, omnivorous and, well, omnivorous and carnivorous morphs, and that cannibalism can occur and all those types of things, and Fennig's research with respect to kin recognition, and some benefits of actually eating animal matter over plant matter. Okay, which is accelerated growth, larger size at metamorphosis, etc. All good stuff. Okay, and it's likely because animal matter has greater nutritional value. All right. All right. So whether or not tadpoles are truly herbivorous, which has been claimed for a very long time, or they're more omnivorous and opportunistically carnivorous is really kind of out for debate, and there's certainly evidence, growing evidence, to show and suggest that they're opportunistically, they can be opportunistically carnivorous, especially some species. And, okay, so the last thing, and I realized I didn't mention this, is one thing that we do see with tadpoles quite a bit is scavenging dead conspecifics, or dead congeners as well. So any dead thing that's sitting there rotting and et cetera, they will eat. Now, the reason I bring that up, that's not surprising because they are known to eat detritus and stuff like that. Why not just go ahead and eat dead organic matter that's not plant matter? Is because this is one of the primary ways that disease is spread, okay? And that's an important thing as we start to get into April when we talk about pathogens and things like that. One of the primary ways that disease is spread is by eating infected individuals. And so there's quite a bit of research that has documented that with different types of pathogens, so. Okay, any questions with that? Yes, sir.
Do all types do this, scavenge on dead things, or is it just the carnivorous?
Do the omnivorous types? Yes, the omnivorous types do scavenge on. Yeah, so bullfrog tadpoles are a good example, so are green frog tadpoles. Yeah, they will scavenge on. Yeah, they don't have to be carnivorous morphs. Carnivorous morphs are, as you can see here, some good examples with Scapiopus. Actually, that's Spia, but they are specifically going after large macroinvertebrates and also predating conspecifics and even small congeners as well. All right, so anyways, there's more information on that. We talked quite a bit about that last time. There's more information on that in the required readings, in Petranka's reading that was published in Ecologia. So, all right, any other questions? All right, we will get through this, this today and post-metamorphic stuff today, so I'm going to go fast. And if we get done in a half hour, I'd just be happy. Of course, that never happens, right? I always try to get done. Seems like I'm here at 7:30 still talking. But I will get done today because basically next week I will not be here. I have to be in Mississippi with our spring camp students, the juniors, and another course I'm teaching. So Liz and Chandler will be teaching. And then when we come back the following week, we have a guest lecture, somebody from EEB coming over. And so I'm not even going to be lecturing for 2 weeks. So I want to get all the biology done. And from here on out, be focusing on conservation. So, All right, environmental relationships of tadpoles. Just like we talked about environmental relationships of embryos and that there are certain ranges of temperature that embryos develop the best at. Similar with tadpoles, and is that higher limit with respect to lethal temperatures that are generally of concern for tadpoles for the most part, because most don't overwinter. So it's usually the hotter temperatures that are of greater concern for the majority of the species. So along the x-axis here, we have acclimation temperature in Celsius. That means basically the temperature that these tadpoles are at. And then this is the lethal temperature. So as you warm these things up, where do they basically expire? And so for tadpoles that are basically acclimated we see a lot of variability, first of all, okay? Where you have species that are two different species that are acclimated at the same temperature, but you can see that they're responding to an increase in temperature differently. Where here they're acclimated at 10 C, and well, actually at 10 C, 20 C, 30 C. Okay, so that must be one species just acclimated at different temperatures. Excuse me. So you can see even within the species, if you're acclimated at a different temperature, you actually can survive a little bit higher of a lethal temperature. However, between species, there's the greatest difference. And ultimately, this is the biggest thing, is that when we really talk about lethal temperatures, we are talking about a range somewhere generally with most tadpoles. We're talking about a range between 34 C and around 42 C. Okay, so anywhere between 93 and 104 degrees Fahrenheit. So they can withstand relatively warm temperatures, although that is, you know, temperatures of, you know, near 100 degrees are not uncommon during the summer in shallow wetlands that are, especially like shallow depressional wetlands that are out in a field, for example, or something where there's no canopy cover. So that's not uncommon. All right, so shallow ponds and also areas, of course, certainly in the tropics where it's always warmer. Generally, species that tend to inhabit the shallow ponds or breed in shallow ponds, they tend to be the species up here as well as tropical species. So an example, and our best example are the spadefoots. They always are on at least the species here in the temperate zones, that always seem to be, they're on that higher range when it comes to being able to tolerate temperature and drought and things like that. So, anyways. Any questions? All right. Phototaxic is a characteristic of tadpoles and amphibian larvae, and it kind of depends on the habitat in which they're developing. Of course, organisms can be positively or negatively phototaxic, and positively means they're attracted to light, and negative they seem to go away from it. And what we see with tadpoles is that tadpoles that are inhabiting ponds or shallow wetlands tend to be positively phototaxic, okay? And in that, they generally are associated near the shoreline. I'm just telling you that this is what's reported, and we'll talk about some issues with it. I'm not saying that it's completely light-driven, but anyways, they seem to be driven towards areas where there's greater light, which usually is the shallower areas where you have greater light penetration. There's a lot of things, as you're probably thinking in your head right now, well, a lot of things could be driving that phototaxis, whether they're attracted light or things associated with that light. So We also see that generally in streams with salamander larvae. Okay, so salamander larvae that are developing in streams. We see a similar thing where they tend to be away from the shoreline and out in and around rocks and stuff within the streams. The relationship is flipped for salamanders in ponds. Generally, salamanders in ponds are negatively phototaxic. They are generally, the larvae generally are not right in the shallows. They tend to even be attracted towards the darker, deeper areas. With tadpoles, they seem to be negatively phototaxic for when they're in streams, like tadpoles, like the glass frogs, etc., that develop within streams. Now, whether or not they're driven by this, you know, there's a lot of other things that are could be occurring with these associations, as you can imagine. So, you know, why might tadpoles be driven towards light in ponds, for example, the shallower areas where light's penetrating more? Yeah, well, that's one thing. Something that's not even related to light at all. It's just that there's shoreline vegetation there, and that's providing cover for them for, you know, reduced predation, etc. There's also more food resources there. Those shallow areas also have greater algal production. Where the light is, you're going to have greater algal production and correspondingly micro and macro invertebrates. And so, anyways, when you read through Dualman's book, you know, just kind of, you know, think about it. And anyways, that's the... Over here, with respect to being negatively phototaxic, especially in streams with tadpoles, well, it might not be a wise thing to go out and venture out into the center of a stream if you're a tadpole, right? Because out there in the center of the stream, you may be more vulnerable to predation. So it's better to live underneath the bank of a stream and to only come out when it's dark, all right? So anyways... there are also, temperature issues too. You know, as you get into the shallow areas, those areas tend to be warmer, and there's a lot of things that temperature drives. So are they really being driven by light or by temperature? But at any rate, from just a general standpoint, tadpoles will be active in ponds during the day, and there is some evidence they may be less active at night, and the opposite is true for when they're in streams. They tend to be more active at night than they are during the day. So in that capacity, there is some evidence that supports that. So any questions? Mm-hmm. I probably think it's due to that most salamander larvae are predators, and most tadpoles are omnivores. You know, it's probably related to the food sources they're going after, I'm guessing. And I don't know. That might be an idea. Any other questions? Okay, what about salinity? Do tadpoles like salinity? No, they don't. No, they pretty much, all species have to be in fresh water or develop in fresh water. They're intolerant of salinity greater than 0.5 parts per thousand. There certainly are some exceptions. One of those is... now I can't remember the common name of that. Bufo viridis. It's over in, I don't know. It's over. I think it's over in Scandinavia. Some, and they only have like three species of anurans. Anyways, I forget the common name. I guess it doesn't matter. But they can tolerate up to 6 parts per thousand, which is right around 45% of the salinity of seawater. So certainly they can tolerate brackish conditions, but that's one of the few species. Most tadpoles, even though probably some of the ancestors of tadpoles came from saline marine environments, brackish environments. Very few can develop within saltwater brackish conditions. What about dissolved oxygen? Do you think that might be important to tadpoles? Probably so, huh? Dissolved oxygen is research that is out there suggests, but they can tolerate pretty low levels, much lower than fish. The research is out there suggests less than 1 milligram per liter is getting into an area that is starts to really stress tadpoles. pH, acidic values of pH, and specifically we start to see a reduction in egg survival, embryo survival, and tadpole survival at pH less than 5, pH is less than 5, as well as abnormalities, different types of malformations. What about nitrogenous waste? If we look at ammonia levels, of course, we're going from the most toxic form here, from ammonia to nitrate. And ammonia levels, most tadpoles are sensitive to ammonia levels that are greater than, we start to see effects greater than 0.5 milligrams per liter. So it doesn't take a whole lot. And Chandler measured, she was talking about ammonia levels in cattle access wetlands, and on average they're around 0.8 milligrams per liter. So we're getting to certainly a point where it's probably stressing some species, and that it is species specific. Some species are not affected, well, by all these parameters. There's going to be some difference, okay, among species, but we start to see some species, like especially some of the ranids, there's some evidence, green frogs, for example, that if you're above 0.5 milligrams per liter, you have an increase in mortality, again, of the embryos, tadpoles, deformities, etc. Toads seem to tolerate higher levels of, at least from the controlled research that has been done, seem to be able to tolerate higher levels of ammonia. And so it would be true for even the less toxic forms. So ammonia is relatively quickly converted into nitrite, and then ultimately nitrate. And nitrite is still relatively toxic to tadpoles, and levels above 2 milligrams per liter can be of concern. And nitrate over, you have to get all the way up over 30 milligrams per liter to really be of concern. And a lot of this, these levels here, at least with nitrate and stuff, you a lot of times don't see that unless you're using a lot of nitrogen fertilizers and getting a lot of nitrogen runoff. In fact, I think, as I recall looking at your data, Chandler, these level, I think your mean levels for nitrite and nitrate were not above these levels, but for ammonia, that they were. So that's pretty major concern there, at least in my opinion. Okay. And the other important thing, again, if you talk to a limnologist, they'll say, well, who gives a darn, because ammonia, is very rapidly converted into nitrate, so it doesn't even, or nitrate than nitrate, it doesn't even matter. Well, it does matter, and for example, with their research, they have nitrogen inputs being, the cattle are going down there and they're defecating all the time. So you continually have inputs of nitrogenous waste, and those levels are staying above this threshold level. Yes, it's rapidly converted, but when you continually have an input of ammonia, then it can be a concern. So anyways, the other interesting relationship between, which if y'all have taken a limnology class, you know this, between ammonia levels and there's a relationship between ammonia levels and temperature and pH. And basically, as temperature increases and pH increases, the amount of ammonia in the water increases as well. There's a greater amount of it that is converted from total nitrogen into this very toxic form of ammonia. So this is just a basic table kind of illustrating this. And we have pH levels going across here on the top, and we have temperatures going down here on the left side. And you can see, as if we just pick one of these columns, if you are at this pH in your pond, and you can see as it warms up, the amount of total NH3 just increases, okay? And if we go across and we increase in actually become more basic, it's at a much faster rate too. You increase the amount of NH3, okay? Starting at the same level of NH3, or total nitrogen, excuse me, all right? So that is a big concern. The more basic your pond is, the more warm it is, the greater the concern that really when you add nitrogen to that system, there can be a greater amount of NH3. And I mean, geez, you know, I mean, right here again, we're talking about areas of concern. So. Any questions with that? All right. So what about, let's move from kind of development stuff into ecology. And again, in future years, I'm going to make sure I structure the class so we have more of an opportunity to talk about ecology, and both in tadpoles, but also post-metamorphically, and we're just running out of time, unfortunately, if we want to focus on some conservation. So pretty much if you look at this figure, it summarizes everything that could happen. So let's first talk about, you know, what are some average densities of tadpoles out there? You know, because that could be of interest, right? That has a lot to do with, you know, competition, those types of things, right? So it's pretty interesting. Tadpole densities can vary quite a bit, and often depends on whether or not you have fish in the environment, because fish are very effective predators on the eggs and embryos and tadpoles. So in fishless, it has been estimated in fishless ponds, fishless ephemeral forested little wetlands, or like, for example, out in those playa wetlands I was telling you about out in Texas where there aren't any fish and you have a lot of spadefoots that are, spadefoots and a lot of bufos that are reproducing in those dry conditions, you can have up to 700 tadpoles per meter squared. That's a massive amount of biomass. And it's pretty crazy. I mean, you can't even really drag a seine net very far, and you stop, and it's just filled up. And you can see a quite drastic change when you have fish in an environment. And this is still even a high estimate here. For the most part, I think that at our wetlands on the Cumberland Plateau, it's even less than that. But, you know, around 5 individuals per meter squared. So obviously those densities are going to affect, numbers of individuals are going to affect competition levels and ultimately competition for food resources, et cetera. So, I mean, that's kind of the main point. So what other types of competitors, though, might there be besides just tadpoles competing with tadpoles? I mean, what other things might compete with tadpoles now that we have an understanding of their general feeding ecology? Yeah, aquatic invertebrates, you know. I mean, You know, there's no doubt that tadpoles are certainly scavengers. They're also they also are eating algae, eating phytoplankton, etc. So a lot of grazers, etc., are doing the same thing. They're eating that periphyton benthic type algae community. So things like, what, anybody know what that is? I don't think so. I think it's a stonefly larvae. Yeah. Oh, did you? I thought you said damselfly. Okay. Yeah. Stonefly. There you go. Very good. Yeah. Yeah. So these are well-known grazers in areas where there's pretty high water quality. And of course, fish themselves, there aren't very many herbivorous fish out there, but fish will eat inverts, small inverts, which, as we talked about before, are a diet item of tadpoles. And of course, we have our conspecific and congeners, which both, you know, obviously compete. So we're dealing with intra and interspecific competition. Now, we talked about the different types of phenotypes that actually can develop based on the amount of competition that is perceived in the environment. And so an omnivore can turn into a carnivore morph based on that perception. And so that is a term, phenotypic plasticity. We'll talk a little more about just adaptive plasticity, which includes phenotypic plasticity later on. So these food resources and these competitive interactions often drive things like phenotypic plasticity and whether or not you observe them in a population. But in general, as density increases, you're going to see a greater number of carnivorous morphs in a population, or at least both morphs in a population, or phenotypes or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that means like bullfrog and green frog tadpoles. Yeah, both. Other questions? Okay. So what about predation, right? Obviously, predation can certainly influence tadpole community dynamics. Both, there are certainly predators on eggs, and then there are predators on larvae. And so what might be some predators here that we have on eggs? Yeah, aquatic inverts and fish, yep. And larvae? Aquatic invertebrates and fish also.
I've heard deer will eat bullfrog.
Really? Well, I would believe it. Deer would probably eat anything, won't they? Yeah, yeah, highly nutritious too, so I wouldn't be surprised. I'm down there drinking and seeing that and just slurping them up. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. That, and also don't forget the tadpoles themselves. Tadpoles, in fact, especially from Petranka's work, can be very effective and influential egg predators, and then you do have the carnivorous morphs which will predate carnivorous and cannibalistic morphs, which will predate small larvae, okay? So we have both larvae, and you have these what are called intra-guild predators. What's intra-guild predators? That's just a fancy name. Intra-guild. Matt, you've been wanting to see the word guild all semester, I think, because you've had a couple questions about it. There you go. So what we're talking about is the guild of, I guess we could just say, amphibians. And within the amphibian guild, we have a predator. And that predator, often salamanders are called intra-guild predators. Salamanders are very they're predators, of course, but they all are, salamander larvae. But they can have a really strong impact on the development of inurine communities. And I wish we just had more time, because there's some awesome studies that have been done that have talked about whether or not, you know, if you have a salamander predator, how does that influence community structure and things like that? But anyways, so, all right, what else? The strategy to try to, one of the strategies, we'll talk about predator avoidance, one of the strategies to try to escape predation is to grow fast and to try to get beyond the mouth size, the gape size of the predator. So there are a couple strategies. One is to grow fast and the other is to be toxic. But as a general rule, most tadpoles are relatively palatable. The bufos generally aren't, although some species of bufo still are eaten by fish. So a good strategy is to try to grow fast and get beyond that, the gape size of the predator. At some point this thing came in, this chemical inhibition. There is research that does indicate if you have two different cohorts of tadpoles, that older cohorts, if they're in presence with younger cohorts, will excrete some type of chemical that has growth inhibition capabilities, growth inhibition capabilities. All right. And that's pretty interesting. I mean, this is within a species, so they can actually slow the growth of their own species, but it's even been shown across species too.
So the old, which ones separated?
Yeah, the older ones. Yeah, the older ones. Yeah. So that's kind of a interesting indirect kind of competitive effect. So, interference competition is what that's called. Interference competition. Okay, so what are some predatory defenses as a tadpole? Well, first of all, you can be impalatable, all right? Don't taste good, but ultimately what it is the toxins. Most tadpoles are not toxic enough to kill things, but they taste bad when they are taken into the mouth. So palatability. Your other defense is to limit your activity around predators. And there's quite a bit of research that indicates that tadpoles that are around predators, both dragonfly predators, insect predators, as well as fish predators, they will reduce their activity. Okay? So they will not move as much. All right. So you ultimately decrease your probability of being detected by that predator and being predated. And another thing is schooling, and tadpoles are known to a lot of tadpoles, at least, not all, but quite a few tadpoles are known to have schooling behavior just like fish do, and it's kind of being a part of a group. Each individual tadpole has a lower probability of being predated. And a very interesting thing is that tadpoles, there has been evidence that suggests that tadpoles often will school within family groups. And that's kind of an interesting thing because, if you're schooling with your family, there obviously must be some competitive advantage to that, okay? And whether it's finding resources or maybe as you're schooling with a group, maybe there's less of a chance that everybody will be eaten from your family group. I don't know. But it has been shown that the composition of schools for tadpoles are often composed of kin groups. Let's see here. So we have these biotic things going on, and predation competition like you would in any community, those things affecting development, etc. And of course we have the physical environment, which we already talked about. And one way that tadpoles can influence that physical environment, the aquatic environment around them with respect to going back to water quality, is through defecation themselves. They are defecating ammonia. They are releasing ammonia into the environment. And especially if you look at and you think about 700 tadpoles per meter squared, that's a lot of feces going into the water. And as we talked about, the transfer time or the passage time of a food item in most tadpoles is less than 5 hours. So they're eating continuously and they're defecating continuously. So there's been some research. This is by Dave Skelly when he was at University of Michigan studying. And Dave actually measured feces production per day at 5 milligrams per tadpole per day. And so that doesn't seem like a whole lot, but when you start to get densities up here, you know, around 700 individuals per meter squared, that can be a pretty significant nitrogen input. And so I did some calculations based on those densities, and what we're talking about is producing something like 35 kilograms per hectare of feces, okay, every day. So 35 kilograms per hectare, that's 31 pounds per acre of feces. That's a lot of crap that's going in there, right, every single day. So they can really influence the water quality, especially in smaller aquatic systems. Now, I did some other calculations just to make things, you know, a little more realistic, and it's probably closer to, for most tadpole communities, around a kilogram per hectare of feces per day is being added. Okay, so more around these more normal ranges of tadpole densities. So that's still a lot of feces, and hopefully I'll have the opportunity later on to present some of the research we're doing that's on the other side of amphibian conservation, looking at it almost in a completely different way from an agriculture standpoint. And that is that we're looking to see whether or not amphibian tadpoles can be suitable hosts for human pathogens, such as E. coli, 0157H7, which is the pathogenic E. coli that we've heard about in the news with the spinach contamination, etc. And it produces a toxin that really can be pretty debilitating to humans. It can kill you. And I bring that up only in the capacity of that if they are suitable hosts, well, the way that this bacteria works is, it infects a host, right? And if it can live in that host and with sublethal effects and not kill the tadpole, for example, well, then it just keeps replicating and it's shedding its feces. Well, if you start to think about the feces shedding rate of tadpoles compared to other vertebrates and fecal inputs into an aquatic system, and considering their densities, it could be pretty damn high and can be pretty serious. And so this is all revolving around an interest right now with USDA and National Institute of Health to try to figure out what are some reservoirs out there. We know cattle are reservoirs of 0157H7, but we don't know wildlife reservoirs and what are significant wildlife reservoirs. We know that deer can carry it. We know that hogs can carry it. But generally, they're at relatively low densities, and with respect to them contaminating water sources, they probably have very minimal impact. And that's actually what's believed. That's the hypothesis that's out there with respect to the spinach contamination, is using contaminated water for irrigation. So, all right, at any rate, I'll maybe share some of that information with you. And those, not only from a nutrient standpoint, I want you to think about that, but also from a pathogen standpoint. Any questions with that? All right. So anyways, one little thing at the end here, the physical environment that we haven't talked about yet that we will in just a second, is, you know, we've talked about temperature and water, quality, dissolved oxygen on the previous slide, this physical environment affecting development and growth, and, oh, geez, you can go all over the place, right? But the other aspect of physical environment is the hydroperiod itself. And again, you know, tadpoles are, a lot of them are developing within ephemeral systems. And you have to worry about that pond system drying up too quickly and you desiccating, not being far enough along in development. And so that brings in a concept of adaptive plasticity, which actually includes phenotypic plasticity and what's called developmental plasticity. And again, Newman's paper that is a required reading talks about that, and we'll talk about it here in just a second, too. Any questions with that? Okay. So, on to metamorph development. So, we've talked about tadpole development. That's it. Metamorph development. Okay. The Gosner stages for metamorph development go from 42 to 46, and it begins with the emergence of the forelimbs. Okay, so once the forelimbs are emerged, right there, okay, 42 to 46, forelimbs are emerged, and really here the mandibles are developed, starting to really develop. At this time, the tadpole is no longer eating, okay? It stopped. There's a lot of things going on internally, and unfortunately, we just don't have the time to get into all the metamorphic changes. Your required readings will give you a little bit of an idea. But, it'll provide some good information. So the forelimbs emerge or come right through the opercular wall, and there they are. And then it ends with the tail being resorbed, okay? So how does the tadpole survive? At this point, the metamorph survive, okay? It's no longer called a tadpole, it's called a metamorph. How does the metamorph survive? I mean, if it's not taking in nutrients, well, how it survives is by metabolizing its own tissue. And so what it metabolizes is the tail. And it's using that energy to restructure its system, to survive, to maintain itself, etc. And once metamorphosis is complete, everything is restructured and it's ready to eat and hop around and disperse if it needs to. And this happens relatively quick. We're probably talking about it can vary, but, well, as everything does, but probably a week's time that can be done, okay? When they are completed, of course, their whole digestive system, everything's being restructured, they secrete urea now instead of ammonia. And again, the process of, or the strategy of ureotele is to conserve water, as you probably remember from your animal physiology classes. So when you're in a terrestrial organism, you don't want to be secreting, you know, ammonia in a diluted type, diluted secretion, because you can desiccate. So it's obviously an adaptation to as many terrestrial vertebrates have an adaptation to conserve water. So how long do tadpoles or larvae just typically develop? Any feeling, y'all? How long does it usually take? Like for the anurans, how long do you think it would probably take to go through Gosner, start from Gosner 1 and go through 46?
2 weeks, a month and a half.
2 weeks?
To a month.
About the fastest is 2 weeks. The spadefoots can develop in 10 days. In fact, it's even been shown in some cases 7 days. Up to a month for the bufos are usually developing within a month, and that's still pretty fast. Your Your hylids are probably next, going into about a month and a half to 2 months, and the ranids can be 2 months to 3 months or even longer than that. So in temperate regions, the anurans are developing. Generally, you're going from Gosner 1 through Gosner 46 in 2 to 3 months in the temperate regions. In the tropical regions, it's faster, okay? Usually 1 to 2 months. And as Casey pointed out, for example, the pelobatids can develop very, very fast just within a couple weeks. Let's see. This really highlights what we talked about before with embryonic development, in that when temperature increases, embryos develop more quickly. And you can see this temperature relationship that exists between the tropics on average and the temperate regions on average, is that generally things develop slower in colder temperatures. Okay? So that's the likely the mechanism behind the differences in duration. Now, what about overwintering? I mean, how often does that occur in tadpole populations? Well, in tadpole populations, it's not very common. The most common species are, that one does occasionally. That's the green frog. And in more permanent ponds, it will overwinter for a year. In ephemeral ponds, it will metamorphose after about 3 months of development. And I don't know if I have, then you can have these big honking ones. I think y'all named that one Goliath, didn't you? Yeah, that huge tadpole. Actually, was it a metamorph by that point? He's just taking his time getting out. That thing's so fat. I don't even know how he's going to hop around when he gets done. But that's a bullfrog. And bullfrogs will prefer to overwinter. And do just fine overwintering bullfrog tadpoles. They can develop within a year. Generally, you see that more in warmer latitudes, or if they just have to. Tadpoles are pretty, that goes into the what's called adaptive plasticity. The developmental plasticity of tadpoles is pretty amazing. And if they have cues that they need to develop, if they're beyond a certain point of development, at least through pre-metamorphosis, then they can accelerate their development. And even though they may be going through metamorphosis at a smaller body size, they can at least complete development if things don't go bad very quickly. So, I mean, if, for example, the water levels are slowly dropping or if water quality is slowly decreasing, they can keep up with that and go through metamorphosis. But if things are good, in general, you see tadpoles, even Scaphiopus, okay, Spia, they can develop this fast, but they will also develop for a month, okay, if conditions are good. And conditions being good mean there's adequate food resources there, low predation pressure, temperature's not too high in that pond, the DO's not too low, water quality's okay. Why go through metamorphosis? And I know I'm kind of explaining that very generally, or anthropogenically, but that is what happens. And so it's good to have that capability, right? Any questions with that?
This is an unrelated question.
Sure.
When you see a bullfrog in the road and you come up and push on it, and yeah, it won't do that, then what's it do?
You know, they have that anti-predatory type defense where they play dead, unless it really is kind of dead and injured.
By the time I look away, it goes.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly it then. Yeah. Yeah, they play dead. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and then when you're not looking, they'll jump and they're gone. Any other questions? Okay, so what happens during metamorphosis? And again, we won't be able to get into this really at all, unfortunately. But there are two hormones that primarily are responsible for metamorphosis, and they're abbreviated T3 and T4. And We can look at their levels and how they change through basically larval development. And so you can see that these levels, these are levels in the blood of T3 and T4, and they're very low in pre-metamorphosis. Remember, this is the stage that they hang out. They want to hang out basically about mid-pre-metamorphosis here, okay? And so we're talking, you know, Gosner 30 to 32, 33, hang out in that as long as you can and just sit there and eat, because you remember, this is the stage here when they grow. That's the stage when you have that sigmoidal exponential growth of tadpoles. So if they can sit in that stage for as long as they can, then that's a good thing. Well, at some point, because of these environmental cues around them, which we'll talk a little bit about what might drive the decision of metamorphosis, they decide, okay, I need to get out of here. And so they progress through Gosner and then begin to excrete or to produce T3 and T4 within the blood system at very high levels. And you can see that it comes up here and it peaks. So prometamorphosis, as you recall, is between Gosner 36 and 41. 42 is the beginning of the metamorph stage or metamorphic climax. And we can see it peaking here. So it's, the metamorphic climax that I mentioned. So we can see T3 and T4 peak right around Gosner 39. And that's when things really are changing in that tadpole. That's when you're getting a lot of restructuring of the tadpole. The mandibles begin to develop. Again, its arms are not, its forelimbs are not emerged yet, but a lot of things are going on internally. Now, you can induce metamorphosis by exposing tadpoles to T3. And so you can play God, and we've messed around with playing God. And before really understanding this natural process, and we found out that if you expose tadpoles that are like 35 Gosner to T3, it's pretty wild. They start naturally because they'll absorb that T3, and they start, all these developmental changes start happening. One of those things, again, internally they start changing. And so they're like, oh my God, I can't eat anymore. And so they start absorbing their tail, metabolizing their tail to stay alive. But the thing that happens often is that their limbs are not far along in development. And by the time their lungs develop and their gills degenerate and their digestive system is complete, they haven't emerged their forelimbs and they drown. So it's kind of an interesting thing. The reason we were trying to figure that out is we wanted to create metamorphs so that we could have a bunch of metamorphs and a bunch of tadpoles and then do different things to them in the lab. And so it is kind of an interesting thing that they need to be late in pro-metamorphosis for that to work effectively without killing them or drowning them. All right, blah, blah, blah. So what are organism effects? I mean, just very basic here. Again, remember, we had a whole darn lecture on metamorphosis plan. So very basic. The intestines go from something that is very long, okay? Now I'm trying to remember. What was it? 1.6 to 8 times the body length, okay, was the length of a tadpole intestine. Okay, 1.6 to 8 times the body length. And it's always shorter when you have when they're exhibiting carnivory or have more of they're taking more animal matter in. What happens there is when T3 and T4 are being produced, the intestines begin to shorten. All right, the tails and the gills degenerate. Okay, again, they're metabolizing these. We don't need our gills anymore. They're equipped and getting ready for terrestrial life. The lungs are already developed, remember, but they're not very developed. Okay, I mean they're not functional. They have very little surface area at this time, is when those, the lungs start to increase in surface area. The skin becomes much more vascularized. Okay, so as a tadpole, remember, they are not respiring very much through their skin. Even though they have that nice big skin area, you would think, and you know, you're in an oxygenated aquatic environment, they are using their gills primarily. Also, you get chromatophores, which we'll talk a little bit about later on, which are being developed, which allow for different types of pigment. Really get a lot more sophisticated development, and the skin begins to thicken for terrestrial life. The lungs become functional at Gosner 44 is when they're basically, they're functional and they're ready to go completely. Although they will start gasping for air before 44, okay? Really exercising those lungs. And they can, as we talked about even before they go through metamorphosis, if they're in pre or pro metamorphosis, if water quality drops, they will go up and still, and they're not getting enough oxygen with their gills, they will go and gulp air, okay? Although they're not getting a whole lot with those gulps, again, because of that very limited surface area of the lungs as tadpoles. Kidneys are developing, changing, and produce urea as the primary waste product. And again, mandibles are really developing to be able to have jaws to bite down and chomp and to grab things, etc. And the eyelids develop, okay? As we talked about, tadpoles don't have eyelids, and so those are developing. They need to keep their eyes moist in a terrestrial environment. The other thing that is very important, and come back to this, and you know, once we hit April, is when we talk about pathogens and stuff, is that the immune system is completely dismantled during this time. Because you can imagine all this crazy stuff going on, your immune system, the adaptive immune system, your white blood cells are freaking out. They're like, oh man, they're trying to kill everything. Well, to prevent that, tadpoles completely dismantle. Their adaptive immune system is basically not functional during this Gosner 42 to 46, okay? And well, I mean, it starts to redevelop, and actually become very sophisticated towards 45 and 46. And it continues to develop after metamorphosis as they go towards adult stage. So this is a critical time here. Metamorphosis is a period where they are highly susceptible to pathogens. And we don't really even understand that aspect yet. Nobody's infected things and followed them through metamorphosis and really gotten a feeling for, we know that their immune system is dismantled, but, and people have suggested, well, yeah, that could be a period of time of high infection rate, but nobody's really looked at that. And actually some of the research we're planning on doing with frog virus 3 has that incorporated. But it's reasonable to believe this is a time where you have lots of mortality, not only from things that just go wrong developmentally, they are very susceptible at this time to predation and things like that, but also infection rates and die-offs happening from pathogens that are in that environment that are just floating around, different bacteria and viruses and stuff like that. Oops, okay, any questions? So, what triggers metamorphosis? Well, there are a lot of things. And again, remember, just kind of think that as a tadpole, you want to stay in pre-metamorphosis, mid to late pre-metamorphosis, as long as you can to grow and become large and go through metamorphosis at a large body size. So you're larger as a metamorph. Incidentally, at this stage right here, okay, 46, this is when they become a froglet or a toadlet. They are a juvenile at this point, okay? From all developmental practical purposes. The metamorph stage ends and they become a juvenile. And we talked about how long they may stay in that juvenile stage with respect to the age of first reproduction, which is when they become an adult, right? Because they are a breeding component of a population. Not an adult until you're a breeding component. That usually, for the anurans, remember, is within, usually within a year, and for salamanders is within 2 years. And there are definitely anurans that develop longer than, or need more than 1 year to become reproductively viable, like the bufos are a good example. But, okay, so, so factors that are that drive metamorphosis, competition does, interspecific and intraspecific competition. So, and this comes down, I mean, there isn't any, there is issues with space with tadpoles, but it's issue with food resources. So density of conspecifics and food resources declining, and also issues that are related to cannibalism and predation, again, because we know that tadpoles themselves can predate on other tadpoles. And somehow these things are perceiving both of these things. And I guess, just like any of us, if you feel like you're in a, you know, you're too crowded, you're sensing something, and you're like, I got to get out of here. You know, this is not a good situation. And that may be a direct assessment of food resources, or it may be some other cue that they, you know, in encounters with lots of tadpoles that may be ultimate, that may have them make a decision about that. The other thing is density of predators. As density of conspecifics and congeners increase, generally developmental rate, or I shouldn't say, yeah, developmental rate is the correct term. Developmental rate, so the time to metamorphosis will decrease. Okay, so developmental rate will increase and time to metamorphosis will decrease. Not in a good way. It isn't because they have better food resources, like we were talking about, maybe a higher animal diet, for example, will increase your rate of development and you're bigger. It's that you're increasing your rate of development and you're smaller. Okay? And the thing is because, and there's some great papers on this, and I wish we could talk more about it, but again, it's the assessment is, I think I'll do better in the terrestrial environment than actually in this aquatic environment here. The same is going to be the same relationship where you have an increase in predators, you're going to have, again, an increase in developmental rate and a decrease in duration to metamorphosis. So that'll be the trend here. In other words, we're trying to get out of the water as fast as we can. So we have an increase in developmental rate and a decrease in the duration to metamorphosis. So, as we already talked about, the other thing that occurs when you have predators is that generally tadpoles are not moving much. If they have a direct perception of them, and predators also excrete, you know, different types of chemicals, etc. And it's been shown that there likely are visual cues. Okay, I see a predator as a tadpole, but there are definitely chemical cues, because even by taking these various chemicals that predators will release and just putting the chemical in the water, tadpoles will reduce their activity. So they're picking up that chemical, and they can recognize that, and that might, in some capacity, increase stress levels and make them recognize that, hey, I don't need to be moving or whatever. Water characteristics, okay, so just the general water quality. So this, again, this abiotic environment around them. what's the water quality? And so, as you might expect, as water quality decreases, generally these things are trying to get out. Whether it's temperature increasing, Yeah, temperature increasing, DO decreasing, ammonia levels increasing. So things that indicate poor water quality, you again have an increase in developmental rate and a decrease to the duration to metamorphosis. Now this may interact also with predation, and so there's been some really interesting studies that have been done that have looked at these weird interactions, for example, pesticides and stuff, and how they may actually, pesticides themselves can reduce mobility of tadpoles, okay, because they can affect them neurologically. And as they slow down, they're eating less, but they're also, they become more vulnerable to predation. So there's a lot of interesting, and research is just being done on this stuff, the interaction of basically chemicals and how this may affect community structure. So you can, they may actually be able to survive some of the environmentally allowable concentrations of chemicals, fertilizers, and pesticides and stuff in the environment. They may be able to survive just fine within the lab, but it's affecting their behavior, and that behavior is increasing their probability of predation, which is resulting in a mortality event. And so a lot of this research is just being done right now. It's pretty interesting stuff. Now, I am going to do something. Probably make a copy of this paper, get it online somehow. It's a really good paper in ecology by guy's last name is Denver. And he did had really elaborate studies that looked at what is driving metamorphosis. And with respect to water, is it the water volume itself? Okay, a decrease in the water volume. Is it, as you decrease water volume, obviously sunlight's penetrating into that water in a smaller volume, it's increasing the temperature. Also things within the water are becoming more concentrated, not only the number of individuals, but also all the chemicals and stuff within that water. And through a variety of controlled factorial type experiments and stuff, he actually demonstrated that the most important thing was volume of water in itself. That tadpoles are primarily cueing in on that volume of water decreasing. Now, that doesn't mean that these are incorrect up here and these don't happen, because they do. In fact, in stable water environments, these are main things driving. The amount of food resources, competition, and predation are driving whether or not, and water quality are driving whether or not they're going to increase their rate of development. If you have good water quality, you have relatively low predators, and density isn't too bad, you're going to hang out, okay? But if these things become, at some point, become stressful so that tadpole ultimately makes a decision to go through metamorphosis, okay, but if you hold all of these things, if you have all these things going on and you decrease water volume, the bottom line is that water volume in itself is more important than water quality, is more important than predators, is more important than competition, okay? Water volume. Well, that makes sense, all right? Who gives a darn about the predators or the competitors or anything if my pond's drying up? I don't have water. I'm in trouble. I better increase my rate of development. I better go through metamorphosis, all right? So these other things don't even come into play if you are decreasing that water volume. So a lot of ephemeral systems are based on that volume. And he hypothesizes its volume, but there's no real, he doesn't know if it's that or whether it's just that they're perceiving the proximity of the water surface coming down. So is it a volume thing or just they perceive that water surface coming down? At any rate, it's a decrease in volume. So, okay, So the last thing here is adaptive plasticity, which has two components. Adaptive plasticity is the evolutionary capability to exhibit different phenotypes depending on environmental conditions. As simple as that. That is actually a definition you should know, not just for this class, but you should understand what adaptive plasticity is. I mean, it's basically your capability from a genetic standpoint to deal with variability in the environment and to exhibit different types of phenotypes based on that. And tadpoles are an awesome example of adaptive plasticity in two different capacities. So you have what's called the geneticists call your genic norm of reaction, which is, this is what I can do. These are the different phenotypes I can exhibit based on these environmental conditions. And if you have a very narrow genic norm of reaction, you don't have a lot of variability. You really only have maybe just one option. Okay, if it's wide, if you have a large genic norm of reaction, you can do different things. You can respond differently to the environment. Two examples are developmental plasticity and polyphenism. And developmental plasticity is a good example is having flexibility in your rate of development. Okay, having flexibility in your rate of development. So, and a good example is like for example spadefoots. But really, all the tadpoles do exhibit this to some capacity, some much more than others. The spadefoots, if they were only fast developing, every time they developed, if they had a narrow genic norm of reaction and they were evolved, they basically go through it as fast as you can, all right, 2 weeks, no more. Then if there were favorable aquatic conditions and they could have stayed around longer, they could have stayed there and developed for a longer period of time and ultimately come out of, gone through metamorphosis at a larger body size. So by having that capability, that developmental plasticity as a tadpole, it allows you to hang out in pre-metamorphosis for a while and get larger. If that wasn't the case, you would fly straight through it. You would never pause. And that happens, okay? I mean, that is the case. Generally, you see this developmental plasticity in tadpoles that are developing in highly variable environments. So, or that have evolved, I should say, have evolved in highly variable environments. You see that in those types of species, which tends to be more the case in temperate than in tropical. So tropical generally have a very narrow developmental plasticity, okay? They're always developing all the time at 30 days, boom, 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 okay? Whereas as you get up into the temperate regions, there's a lot of variability within a species. And for some species, lots of variability, could be very fast or quite a bit longer, and then for other ones, just, you know, not as much. Now, polyphenism is what we've talked about already, and that's actually being able to exhibit two different types of phenotypes with respect to foraging strategy, whether you're an omnivore or a carnivore. And so omnivores can become carnivores, and Dave Fennig has demonstrated that in the lab. And again, there are a lot of cues behind why they become carnivores, and generally it's related to food resources and density of conspecifics. So. Anyways, there's the paper on Newman's paper is a pretty good paper to read over, and that's one of the required readings. It talks all about adaptive plasticity. Good? Any questions? I do it every time, the 707. Oh yeah, I'll just fly through a lecture, won't I? Okay. Well, the good thing is we only have 4 slides for the next one, so we will be able to wrap up by 7. 20 minutes. Make me go through the slides fast. Any questions on this stuff, though? Okay. So let's talk about post-metamorphosis, and this is kind of a bummer because this is one of my favorite topics, is post-metamorphic survival. And I guess we'll just kind of go through it. The good thing is that Betsy Rothermull, she talked quite a bit about post-metamorphic survival on a dispersal standpoint, so you got a good exposure to that. And a lot of the conservation aspects, we'll be talking about post-metamorphic survival and what's happening to these things in the environment and et cetera. So we'll hit this a lot of different ways, but we'll just kind of start off with this basic presentation, very short presentation. So get you all familiar here with post-metamorphic survival strategies. So this includes three chapters. These chapters are relatively short, so I know that seems like a lot of reading, but it really isn't, and it's all good reading. You'll enjoy that reading. And then the handout that you all had on estivation and hibernation, because I have one slide on each. Just going to hit it, unfortunately, barely talk about it. So read through it, and this chapter, is a chapter out of a really good book, Environmental Physiology of the Amphibians. And it's actually, for an environmental physiology book, it's a pretty easy read, so I think you'll enjoy that. Okay, so we'll talk about estivation and hibernation real quick. How do amphibians acquire food, the anurans and the caudates, and predator defenses? And that's it. So what is estivation? What's estivation? What do you guys think?
Hibernation, but opposite.
It's actually very similar to hibernation, except that it's in response to dry and hot conditions. Yeah, as opposed to hibernation, which is cold. So it is a reduction in metabolic rate. Okay, I think I have a definition here. Here we go. The state of reduced metabolism. So it's a reduction in metabolic rate in response to dry conditions and hot temperatures. Okay, a reduction in metabolic rate in response to dry conditions and hot conditions, and/or hot conditions. Okay, so it's a physiological change. All right, I mean it's not just avoiding hot and dry conditions, it's actually, they're reducing their metabolism, and they can reduce it tremendously, okay, like 90% of normal active metabolism. Okay, so let's say that's what they do, okay, they're doing it. How do you break estivation? Well, so these, again, our spadefoots are a good example. How do you break estivation? Well, again, hot, dry, well, to break it, you need rain, right? And in particular, I'll mention, as far as rain goes, it's first rain. And it has to be warm enough. I guess let me just put these other ones here. Okay, so there are three things, really, rain, photo period, and temperature. And really, probably, I should have put it in the order of rain, temperature, photo period. But and these two are intertwined, two and three anyways. The bottom line is what these are saying is that when you have shorter days and it's colder, you are not going to break estivation. All right, you have to have longer days, and it has to be warmer for them to come out of estivation. So you can kind of even think of estivation ultimately really in drier areas when it gets colder can become quote-unquote hibernation because all hibernation is basically the same thing, but it's in response to cold. It's that though they start off a lot in dry environments estivating, and the primary reason that they've reduced their metabolic rate is because of dry and hot conditions, not because of the cold, and then it gets cold and it's still dry, so they just hang out there. But if it rains in the middle of winter, they aren't going to come jumping out of the ground. Okay, so rain is it. Now, once it rains, and it has to rain a lot, okay? I mean, we're talking to break estivation out of winter, out of spring, and it to be warm enough. We're usually talking about summer. It has to rain a couple inches. I mean, they literally have to feel the ground being wet, okay? And they come out of estivation, they come out of the ground. These are generally burrowing species like toads and spadefoots and stuff. And they come out of the ground. Now, once the estivation has been broke, then these other two factors come into importance. We'll talk about the depth of these, how far they'll burrow down. But once it's broken, they stay very close to the surface, generally, okay? Unless the surface soil dries out, then they'll keep going deeper. But then they respond very quickly to changes in barometric pressure and even thunder. In fact, there's several studies that have shown that, I've actually observed this, is walking out there in the desert, the southern high plains, and a thunderstorm is off in the distance and it's approaching, and all of a sudden you see spadefoots hopping around. They cue in on these the changes in barometric pressure and the vibrations from thunder, and that's actually been shown in the lab, reproduced in the lab. But that is only important once you have a good soaking rain. Then they'll cue in on those. Now, the burrows themselves, burrows are non-randomly distributed, and generally you see congregations of individuals. Now, where are those located? Well, those are located in areas where it's moist. Now, for the most part, toads and spadefoots, the ones that are really estivating, truly estivating, or frequently estivating in these dry areas, they are going up into the terrestrial environment, and they're estivating in areas that generally have high moisture content. Maybe there's a drainage coming down or whatever. Few actually will estivate within the bottom of the pond, and what I mean by that is, unlike ranids, which will go down into the water and even hibernate underneath the water and in the sediment area, spadefoots and toads don't do that, okay? Now, as the water recedes, they may dig down into the pond, or if it's in a really dry area, basically as the water recedes, the soil will crack, and they may actually even go down into the cracks of the soil and get down really deep. But in general, by the time that's happening, the adults, the metamorphs may not, because they'll be around still foraging the juveniles and stuff and kind of right by the water. They will be up at least out of the basin of the wetland. Okay, so the bottom line is they estivate, but they have to remain moist. If they become dry, they dry out, they'll die, okay? They have to remain moist. And the other thing is, when they're estivating, they are using their lungs very little, if at all. Okay, so they're primarily respiring through cutaneous respiration. And it is at a much lower rate, like 90% less of a rate. Okay, so their oxygen transfer is very low. They can respire just fine underneath the ground through their skin. But that skin needs to remain moist. So what the strategies are, and the primary strategy is always to be in contact with moist soil. So when it rains and you've come out of estivation, it's all good. Soil, top of the soil is moist, but then it gets hotter, it gets drier. And basically what you see are the individuals, the organisms that are estivating, they will continue to dig backwards into the ground as they sense the soil around them getting warmer and drier. They'll just continue to go deeper and deeper into the soil. Now, so it's kind of an interesting thing. Usually in the summer, when it is generally hot, but it's raining, usually these systems are monsoonal type systems where you have really, really dry areas. So they'll be right near the surface. The soil will still be wet, but as it dries out, you'll see them digging deeper and deeper, and by winter they can be a half a meter deep. Okay? Well, that does take, as you can imagine, well, that's a good distance to be hibernating, and it takes a good amount of rain to percolate down to ultimately wake these guys up the next year. Now, some species, this is pretty rare. The only species that I know of that does this in the United States is the Coucha spadefoot. Our other spadefoots, to my knowledge, do not do this. And that is create a cocoon. But there are other species around the world that do this. And what they do, as far as, it's not like an insect cocoon, they are actually shedding their skin, shedding dead skin and mucus and encapsulating themselves in this sheath of dead skin and mucus. And it looks sort of like a cocoon. And they, let's see here, that cocoon can reduce evaporative water loss from their skin by 90%. Okay, remember they got to keep that skin wet. And oxygen transfers fine through the cocoon, and there isn't any problem with that either. Oh, sorry, I thought I had something else on there, but I guess I didn't. So, all right, any questions with that? All right, so hibernation is the same thing, a reduction in metabolic rate in response to cold, okay? So they're actually relatively, well, no, I shouldn't say that. Okay, I'll just stop there and not say it. But it's a reduction in metabolic rate in response to cold temperature. So generally there are three strategies as an organism. How can I deal with cold? What do you think? How can you deal with cold? If you're an ectothermic individual out there. Find a warm place, avoid it. Okay, that is one strategy. You avoid it by burrowing down, like the toads. Okay? Okay, that's one strategy. Find a warm place. And that's usually burrowing. The second strategy.
Fat and hairy.
Yeah, turn into a bear. Unfortunately, I haven't seen that happen.
Congregate with your neighbors,
yeah. Except everybody, you know, they're not homeotherms, you know, they're not producing heat. So everybody's cooling down at the same temperature. You know, there's the person next to you is cold. Reduce body function, that's right. You're going to reduce that. Now let's think about cold and what happens when you get really cold. You shiver, okay, that's a homeotherm, okay, and trying to produce metabolic heat. What are you trying to avoid? I mean, what would be really bad if you're homeotherm or an ectotherm?
Freezing.
You freeze, right? Yeah. And specifically intracellular freezing. If water within your cells freeze, it doesn't matter. You're dead, okay? Your cells rupture, you're dead. And actually, even the ones that can withstand freezing, they have things to prevent that from happening. But if it happens, they die. So you can avoid it, okay? You can be tolerant of freezing. In other words, you have some ability to withstand freezing. And then the other is actually submergence in water, which is another way of avoiding freezing. But this is basically submergence in water is being in the aquatic environment, all right? But you have concerns related to hypoxia. You get down in the bottom of the sediment or in the water, low oxygen conditions, especially as you get into winter time. Then you have hibernation in a burrow, and the whole idea is avoid the cold. And then you have hibernation on land, and here again, these are similar in the capacity of avoiding. And here you're not avoiding, you have evolved the capability to tolerate freezing. So those are the three strategies. The first strategy, submergence in water, is common for our ranids. Okay, most of our ranids are overwintering and hibernating within aquatic bodies of water. Actually, the majority of them do not bury themselves in the sediment. They're actually above the sediment, just laying there. And we've caught bullfrogs in February before out there dip netting for tadpoles, and the next thing you know, you come up with this bullfrog. It's like, what in the heck is going on? You know, and then they warm up about, you know, an hour later, and they're like, hey, all right, let's go. Hibernation, we're dealing now with our bufals and our pelobatids. These guys are the ones that are the greatest chance of estivating, too. Again, you see them in more drier types environments. And then hibernation on land, like all of our hylids. And so we have all of our, what family are we missing here from Tennessee?
Microhylid.
Yeah, our microhylid. And I don't know what they do, honestly. I don't know, but I'll find out. I think they may burrow, actually, find burrows, because microhylids are often common in drier areas. They may do a couple of these things. I'm not sure. All right. Well, actually, and now that I've said that, microhylids are primarily have a tropical distribution, so they don't hibernate very often. But we have some. Of course, we have a couple species here in the States. What about salamanders? Well, salamanders, if they are aquatic salamanders, well, they're doing number one. If they're terrestrial salamanders, they're generally doing number three. And a few may find burrows. So there are different physiological strategies to survive, especially this, that I want you to read about in that handout, okay? So read about how these organisms are dealing with these things, especially number three. How do you survive that freezing? It's pretty interesting stuff. And, okay, it has to do with the basically changing stuff outside of the cells so that stuff in your cells doesn't freeze. Now, it has been estimated that overwintering survival is pretty darn, well, I don't know, I guess. Depends on whether the glass is half empty or half full, right? About 50% mortality, and it can range for some species up to around 75% mortality occurs over winter in response to hybrid, you know, cold mortality, okay? Any questions? All right. Food acquisition. All right. Anurans and salamanders, for the most part, are very visually oriented. They cue in on their prey items. And most are sit and wait predators. Salamanders tend to be more more mobile, but for the most part, as far as the anurans are mostly sit and wait. Now, they may pursue, and if you've ever watched a frog, some of them will just sit there and then boom. But especially toads, they'll even kind of chase after something and grab, and well, not grab it, but they'll eat it. We'll go through how they do that. But there may be some pursuit, generally not too far. But so they're mostly sit and wait predators. And a lot of the salamanders are too. The primary stimulus and one of the biggest things is movement. There's been a lot of studies that have shown that, in fact, I've done this before, until you train your toads to do this. If you drop a dead cricket in a tank with a toad, and they actually didn't see it drop, you know, they see that movement, they'll just sit there and they won't recognize it. Now, if you have them long enough, you can train them to actually see that. But movement is a big key. The other thing is size. You can put in a real small ant, for example, and a large bufal won't eat it because they aren't perceiving it as a food item. Just like all things out there, birds or whatever, you know, when it comes to predators, they have a search image, and they it needs to be within their search image, and that search image can change depending on food availability and learning. But for the most part, it's within some size range, which is related to their gape size and their ability to see it, and it needs to be moving. Okay.
Would a smaller frog have a lower size?
Absolutely. And even through life, through the development, it's changing. So, yeah, your little metamorphs, you know, this big, are eating little things, little ants and stuff like that. And they aren't even looking at big things. Yeah.
This is kind of a crazy question. Not related. But in my classroom, I have two aquariums, and I have two rats in one. Mm-hmm. And then I have some type of, I don't know, Egyptian toad in another. Mm-hmm. And over the weekend, I came back in Monday, and the lid was off the rat cage, and there's no more toad.
Oh, really?
Actually, what rats eat.
Well, yeah, I have never heard of a rat eating a toad before. That's pretty wild. I guess it's possible. You know, I mean, how big was a toad? Is it a good sized toad? Wow, that's pretty amazing. I'm kind of surprised that you wouldn't see some to eat it completely and not find any remains. Especially, you know, toads, I mean, it has large, oh God, dang, completely. Thank you, paratoid glands. Yeah, I mean, I would find it hard to believe.
It's like his water bowl was turned over, its little cave that hit him was turned over, like all the vegetation inside.
I would.
Everywhere, so.
Could it have gotten out?
I locked the door as soon as I leave.
Yeah. I wonder if it got out. I mean, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. It could. Yeah. Huh. Well, I don't know. I do find it surprising that you wouldn't have found the head. But yeah, that's a good one. Either I would. My guess would be somebody took it and tried to, you know, make it look like something weird, or that in the process of maybe the rat getting over there, somehow the toad got out. I don't know if it could have gotten out or even jumped out or whatever. That might not even be possible, but it could be some place. I've had toads get out or things get out, salamanders or something, and find them a long time later, and they're, you know, in a corner someplace all shriveled up. But anyways, yeah, I don't know. So as far as salamanders and frogs and stuff, most salamanders and most frogs do have a protrusible tongue, meaning that it can come out of their mouth and they can grab things. Well, I mean, they don't grab it, but they secrete very sticky secretions on their tongue. And a lot of species have even a rough tongue that helps stick to things. And so generally what you see, this is just a schematic of an ambystoma, and it's kind of a trough-type tongue, and it does come out of the mouth, but usually not very far, and that's generally the truth for salamanders. Their tongues don't come out very far, maybe just 8% of their body length. So they come out, and they kind of stick in, they take it back in, they chow down. The anurans, on the other hand, probably the most common thing is a flipping type action of the tongue, and their tongue is folded. It's folded back like this, and you can see the prey item there, and they flip it out. So it's actually sitting, you know, back like this in the mouth, and they open their mouth and they flip it out and they hit the prey item on the back side of their tongue, okay, and then they bring it back in and then they scrape it off the back side of their tongue, like that, and they ingest it. And that happens lightning fast. Now, the tongues of anurans can be pretty darn long, even half of their snout vent length, and it's very fast, around a tenth of a second, that basically they come out, boom, and back in, and they ingest it in even faster time. So down the esophagus in 0.07 seconds. So, anyways, pretty neat. Oops, okay. Any questions there? So, the last thing here is predator defenses, and this goes back to one of the questions Jeremy had the first day about, you know, how to. There are a lot of different predator defenses, and I want you to read about those. in your reading, in Dulman's reading, but I thought I would just focus on one of the most common predator offenses, which is skin. So the skin has a variety of different types of cells. This is called a chromatophore unit, and within it has different types of cells. It has xanthophores, which produce red, yellow, and orange pigments. Okay. And for some reason, now I did something and freaked out the computer. Okay. And a radiophore, which reflects light, okay, and gives some frogs an iridescence type color, and salamanders, and melanophores. Melanophores are very mobile, and depending on, this is what is most often the distribution of melanin within the melanophores is what is changing the color, the quick color, that adaptive color that goes within seconds to a couple minutes. That distribution, whether it's distributed throughout the melanophores or whether it's centrally located or if it's just on some edges, it will change the color and result in different reflections of the xanthophores and the radiophores. So that is the primary thing that is changing, is the redistribution of melanin, okay, within the melanophores. So 2 months later, I finally gave you an answer. All right. So there are two main cryptic or main types of coloration. One is cryptic coloration, which you all have learned about in ecology. It's a camouflage type coloration, which reduces your probability of predation. And so you guys remember what those are? Those are, yeah, the cryptic frogs up there kind of look like leaves. And then aposematic coloration, which is just warning coloration, right? And it warns predators of toxins. So, you know, the dendrobatids are a great one. Now, most of, for as far as the toxins, what are they? For bufos, they're a cardiotoxic steroid. And for dendrobatids, which are also, you know, well known to have toxins, they're a steroid alkaloid, okay? And basically, the way that these usually function is that they mess around with the nerve cells and they prevent signaling of the nerve cells. And often these toxins are targeting the heart, okay? Cardiotoxic, right? Are targeting the heart, and what happens is it messes up that communication and the heart ultimately ceases. The heart contracts and it stays contracted, okay? And organisms end up dying from, I guess, cardiopulmonary failure. So they have a heart attack. What's that? No, yeah, not to my knowledge, yeah. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. Oh. Oh, really? Interesting. Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah. Where'd you see that?
It was in the beacon.
Oh, it was, really? Oh, cool. That's pretty neat. Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't aware of that. That's neat. And some of the toxins are hallucinogenic. One of those is the Sonoran toad, and it produces a hallucinogenic toxin.